Maine Calling Book Club reconvenes to discuss Arthur Miller's classic play, Death of a Salesman. Death of a Salesman was first performed in 1949, the same year it won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama and the Tony Award for Best Play. It has endured as a staple of American theater. Even though its story takes place in a different time, it remains fresh and relevant today. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss the enduring appeal of Death of a Salesman. What does it say about the notion of the American dream, and how has that changed? Does Willie Loman represent every man? What about the symbolism in the book? The automobile, the rubber hose, the women's stockings, the jungle. Have you read Death of a Salesman? Seen the play performed? What did you take away? The Maine Calling Book Club is next, but first, this news update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. An investigator for the German Wings plane crash in the French Alps says cockpit recordings point to the co-pilot deliberately bringing down the plane. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports investigators have no idea what could have motivated the co-pilot's behavior, but they reject the theory of terrorism.
C'est alors qu'il est seul.
Prosecutor Brice Robin gave a blow-by-blow account of the last minutes in the cockpit. He said after the pilot left for a break, the co-pilot took the plane off automatic pilot and began descending. He refused to let the pilot back into the cockpit and ignored calls from radio control in Marseille. Robin said throughout the final minutes, the co-pilot's breathing is audible, though he never utters a word, even when the altitude alarms go off and the pilot screams and bangs on the door to be let in. Robin said officials do not believe the actions of the 28-year-old German co-pilot were terrorism. Minutes later, Lufthansa CEO Carsten Spohr called the findings an airline's worst nightmare. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Secretary of State John Kerry sat down with Iran's foreign minister today in Switzerland, with just days left to reach a framework nuclear agreement. Anticipation of an accord is growing, but NPR's Peter Kenyon reports it's still far from certain.
On the eve of this critical round of talks, a senior U.S. official said, "We can see a path forward to get to an agreement," adding that more progress was made last week here in Lausanne than at previous rounds. Still, the official said, that doesn't mean we'll get there. Top diplomats from America's five negotiating partners, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, are expected to arrive in the coming days if there appears to be enough progress to close in on a framework agreement. If the sides can announce the major elements of a deal next week, negotiators will have a new sense of momentum as they move toward a final deadline at the end of June. If not, officials say President Obama will have to consider how best to proceed. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Lausanne, Switzerland.
The Obama administration is planning to crack down on the payday lending industry. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau today releases proposed regulations. Andrew Yeager of member station WBHM says they're aimed at preventing low-income borrowers from being trapped by high fees and rising debt.
Payday lending has been a focus of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau ever since its first field hearing in 2012, which happened to be in Birmingham. Critics of these businesses say they trap low-income consumers with ballooning fees and interest. The industry responds by saying they're just offering needed loans, and these people can't get them anywhere else.
President Obama heads to Alabama this afternoon, where a high number of payday lending businesses operate. Power crews in Oklahoma and Arkansas are working to restore power after severe storms. On Wall Street, the Dow is off 1 point, the Nasdaq down 7. This is NPR. In Oklahoma and Arkansas, power crews are working to restore power to thousands of customers after suspected tornadoes swept through the area yesterday. One tore through the Tulsa suburb of Sand Springs and damaged dozens of buildings. One person was killed. At least 9 are hospitalized. Farm workers in Mexico are preparing to launch an international boycott against multinational companies that export fruits and vegetables to the U.S. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, workers in the northern state of Baja California are demanding better salaries and working conditions.
Hundreds of farm workers in the agricultural valley of Baja California have been on strike for more than a week, seeking higher wages, medical benefits, and an end to what they say is routine abuses by labor bosses. Workers, mostly berry and tomato pickers, say they make less than $8 working stooped over for 10 to 12 hours a day. They want the large agribusinesses in the region, the majority of whom export fruits and vegetables to the United States, to triple wages and respect all national labor laws. Mexico's Independent Human Rights Commission opened an investigation into the mistreatment of striking protesters. Last week, hundreds were arrested after blocking a major north-south highway. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
Florida is now the country's third most populous state and home to the country's fastest-growing metro area. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau, which says the population of the Villages west of Orlando grew faster than any other metro area. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Constant Contact, committed to helping small businesses and nonprofits succeed with email and online marketing tools, with coaches to provide guidance and help organizations meet their goals. More at ConstantContact.com.
With this look at Maine news, I'm Erwin Gratz. Ohio's Republican Governor John Kasich is in Augusta today, pushing for a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Kasich, joined by Governor LePage, is urging the Maine legislature to petition Congress for a constitutional convention. 34 state legislatures would have to pass such resolutions to force a convention, which would be charged with drafting the amendment. A Hudson man, Sean McNevin, has been indicted on drunk driving charges for a New Year's Day car crash that killed his fiancée, Elizabeth Horlicka. Police have identified a skier from Bethel who died in an accident yesterday at Sunday River Ski Area. He was Benjamin Taylor, who fell while skiing a double diamond trail and hit a tree. University of Maine at Farmington researcher Nancy Prentice has made a small discovery. Actually, in the world of biology, it's big, a whole new genus and species. But that new genus and species is a marine worm that lives in water off the U.S. Virgin Islands.
One year, I was snorkeling and turning over rocks and found this particular animal, and it was very unique looking because of the way that it builds calcium carbonate tubes.
Those tubes were in the shape of concentric circles, the worm inside white with red stripes. It has taken 5 years of DNA testing and other checking, but Prentice has now published her determination that what she found is a new genus and species, Turbocavus secretus. Attorney General Janet Mills says the state is settling its case against Bathfitter, a Portland company she says engaged in unlicensed plumbing activity. The settlement will include free inspections and a promise by Bathfitter to follow state law. Taking a look at the weather, look for clouds to tighten up over southern Maine, rain beginning later this afternoon, spreading down east by late in the day and into northern Maine tonight. I'm Erwin Gratz, MPBN News.
From the MPBN studios in Bangor, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A few years ago, the Denver Post asked 177 theater experts and students to rank the most important American plays. Atop the list, Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. First ran on Broadway in 1949 and tells the story of the Lowmans and the search for the American dream. Today, our book club switches gears a little to talk about this iconic dramatic work. It's the first time we've tackled a play. With me in our Bangor studios, Tom Makatowicz. He is professor of theater at UMaine School of Performing Arts. John Mann is chair of international business, policy, and strategy, and a professor of management at the University of Maine. Joining us from our Portland studio, Christine Marshall. She's the artistic director at Mad Horse Theater Company in Portland. And, of course, we want to hear from you. What did you think of Death of a Salesman? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you all, and thank you for being here on Maine Calling today. I'll start here in the Bangor studio with you, Tom Makatowicz. What does Death of a Salesman mean to you?
Oh, well, it's obviously surrounding the American dream, the theme of the American dream. And I think it's a theme that, you know, certainly was true in the mid-20th century when the play opened on Broadway. But certainly it's still true today that I think the play resonates with audiences even to this day. In fact, Miller's plays are very highly produced. I had heard that they at one time, and I don't know how true it is, that they were more produced than Shakespeare's plays at one time, you know, in the last 10 years. So I know that he's been very popular, but the play is read by many high school students, and it's a critique of our American values to some extent. And I think it's also a spooky play. It's a tragedy, and you follow these people along, you know, through the action, which is very complex, but that I think in the end it, you know, it gives you a sense of, you know, what it means to be an American and to live in this capitalist society, actually. The play grew out of those ideas. So, you know, I think that it also, you know, resonates on the sense of, you know, personal relationships. You know, the worst lie you can tell is the lie that you tell yourself. And this play actually is a really good example of that. Within, you know, as Willie Loman, the lead character, exemplifies that, as well as his son Happy.
That's it. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. I mean, the lies are throughout the book. John Mann, what about you? What does this book mean to you?
To me, it seems to expose a lot of the myths that we hold even to this day. Myths around what's success, myths around the need to look good or to be attractive in order to succeed, and also the fear of change. We all, I think many of us at various times in our life, get stuck in a rut, and we stay there because of the fear of the unknown, the horror of the present, if I could use that, is at least more comforting than the fear of the unknown.
Do you think that that's why Willie Loman doesn't take the job from Charlie, because he's afraid?
Yeah, I think it's two things. One, I think it's he's afraid because he sees himself as a salesman, and it's never quite clear what Charlie wants him to do. He says he will pay him to do something, and I think that he's so welded to where he's at, and the fear of making that leap paralyzes him.
And Christine Marshall, what does Death of a Salesman mean to you?
Well, I came to Death of a Salesman far too emotionally immature to understand it. I was a little girl, and my parents had a Time Life series called This Fabulous Century. I actually pulled it out and brought it with me. And in the 40s to 50s section, there were these large pictures of the explosion of American theater, Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, and then plays like Oklahoma. And there's this picture of Lee J. Cobb, who originated the role, and he's just in full rant. And I found it fascinating and somehow, like, frightening. And as I read about it and got older and older, I began to understand more of the play. And yet I have to be honest and say that it's relentless, and I don't know that it's not an easy play for me to watch or read. It's relentless, and I think that that's part of its power, is that you get drawn into something that it's a juggernaut. It's not going to slow down until the end. That being said, that can be a very hard experience for a theater goer, and for me, it took me a long time to come around to the power of the play and the number of elements at work in the play. And I think now we also look at this play maybe through a new lens that was not necessarily intended at the time, but I think a lot of people look at Willie Loman differently now, and sometimes through the lens of, are we looking at dementia? Do you know what I mean? Are we looking at those relationships too? Because that's a very big part of the story, that he's drifting away.
That's interesting, and I wondered the same thing, Jim. I mean, excuse me, John.
Christine, I think you're really on to something. This is, I think, one of the earliest plays that actually ends badly. Oof. In other words, this is not a joyous play. You know, if you think about it, we are so used to going to the movie and or seeing plays, and they're uplifting. At the end, you kind of walk out with a little extra hop in your walking here. Here, I think you walk out of the play, and it's like, Oh, my God. Yeah, and you really have to reflect on it.
Now, Christine and Tom, I want to ask each of you, have either of you ever staged Death of a Salesman? I'm wondering, reading it, I was wondering, boy, this must be hard. This must be hard to stage because you're having to stage, even though Arthur Miller gives these specific instructions, you're having to stage flashbacks.
Yeah, I'd like to speak to that. I think I mentioned that it is a spooky play. It is a tragedy, but there's this overwhelming sense of dread that goes throughout the scenes. And actually, just even talking about the setting, because since this isn't a novel, one would see the set on stage, and the way it's described in the text and the way Joe Melziner, the original designer, he was a great designer in the mid-20th century, you know, the set is described as a, the entire setting is wholly or in some places partially transparent. The roof line of the house is one dimensional. Under and over it, we see the apartment buildings. And so there's this picture of this beautiful little American house that's old and needs repair, and it's being dominated by these apartment buildings surrounding it, which really is, you know, the whole idea that America is growing too fast for these people anyway, and they it encroached upon them. But in terms of the other thing, the other description is whenever the action is in the present, the actors observe the imaginary wall lines entering the house not only through its door on at the left, but in the scenes of the past, these boundaries are broken and characters enter or leave a room by stepping through a wall onto the fourth stage. So this is kind of breaks reality, obviously, because there are imaginary walls set up the way the setting is designed. But when Willie goes into a daydream, the characters move through the walls. And this kind of is rattling as well.
And is this enough for an audience? Does the audience get that what's going on is a flashback?
They do. And I have never staged this myself. But many years ago, when I was just getting out of college, I saw a production in Erie, Pennsylvania, starring the famous actor Morris Karnofsky, who was a contemporary of Ilya Kazan's. And in fact, Kazan mentioned him in the House Un-American Activities Committee. But Karnofsky was a brilliant actor, and he played the part. And I saw him age and get young as well.
Wow.
As move back and forth through time. It was a very exciting production. But I agree with Christine. It's a difficult production.
And Christine, what about you? Have you ever put this on?
We haven't staged Death of a Salesman fully. We did a series one season ago. we called it a six-pack of Miller, and they were six staged readings.
That's cute.
It was, well, you actually won a six-pack if you came to all six readings, which is great. And we staged six of his pieces, All My Sons, The Price, which is a really lovely play that I don't think it's produced as often as it could be. After the Fall, Death of a Salesman, and View from the Bridge. I've left something out. But we did it as a staged reading, and it was a really great experience to hear his language and to hear how it changed. I would say that this is one of those plays, like Joe Melziner was a magnificent set designer and really broke ground for a lot of American set designers. And I would say that with a play like, we ended up choosing A View from the Bridge for the beginning of this past season from all those shows. I have to be honest and say I didn't think I could plow through Death of a Salesman as a production. Mm-hmm. And View from the Bridge is, it's just, it hits the ground running and it doesn't stop, but it's also a very fast-paced play. But I think that there is nothing that anybody needs to do to a design, set-wise, of Death of a Salesman that would confuse an audience if you stuck to the original material as written by Miller, or as written, sometimes those directions are written actually at the first production, what the set looks like. But for a lot of these playwrights in the mid-20th century, they were very, very specific about things happening on stage. I think that the audience follows along with it completely. I've seen productions of it as well. And nothing, I've never seen anybody try and tweak this. You know, a lot of times people will do that with a play, particularly a classic. They'll try to approach it.
This isn't one of
those. No, well, they'll try to approach it from a new direction, and I don't think this play requires it in any way. It's obvious when he goes to another place.
Great.
Yeah, there was a revival in 2012 starring Philip Seymour Hoffman on Broadway, directed by Mike Nichols. And they recreated Joe Melziner's set because Nichols said there's no other way to do it, essentially.
I want to get back to the theme of the American dream because, boy, we could talk the whole hour about this idea, and I have more notes than just about the American dream. But what do you all believe is the American dream in as defined by Willie Loman? Is it to be rich? Is it to be handsome? Is it to have your own business? Is it to have people look up to you? John?
I really actually think it's perhaps a little bit more simpler than that. When I read through the play, it's to be somebody. I think that if you go back, in my view, and I bow to my colleagues who are more drama-oriented than I am, but I think, to me, when I read the play, Loman wants to be somebody. And I don't, although he makes comments about making money and things like that, I think he wants to be respected. He wants to be greeted. He wants to be recognized. I think I told you, well, one of my favorite, without talking to my wife, I should say, one of my favorite quotes here is where Linda, I'm trying to find it really quickly, is talking about he's not the finest character that ever lived, but he's a human being and a terrible thing is happening to him. Attention must be paid. Mm. He is not to be allowed to fall into his grave like an old dog. I think for him, the American dream is, I want to be somebody.
Thoughts? Christy?
Well, nobody shows up. Oh,
at the
funeral,
that's right.
Nobody shows up at the funeral.
Yeah, nobody. Yeah. Nobody, so he never made it.
You know, I'm wondering because in that reading, when you realize that he ended up taking his own life, when nobody showed up at his funeral, that his children had not been great successes, he's viewed as a failure. But upon reflecting, I'm wondering if some ways Willie Loman isn't also a hero because he takes his own life so that he can set up his son so he can get the insurance money and set up his son. He has paid off his home. His wife is going to be able to live in the home. And I don't think it's all dismal.
Well, this is what scholars have argued about for many, many years. Willie is the tragic hero. Typically, tragic heroes have a raising of consciousness throughout the action. Mm-hmm. So through the character progression, they learn something. And many people have argued Willie hasn't learned a thing. He's still a fool and does foolish things at the end of the play. And so this has been fodder for debate, mm-hmm. for decades, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a refrain in Arthur Miller's work about my name. I want my name. It's set in A View from the Bridge. It's set in The Crucible, and I think there's something to that. Speaking to the comment before about all of those things that you mentioned, money and respect. I think they come down to wondering if you actually mattered on this planet. You know, we talk about midlife crises and all of the things that people go through when they start asking themselves if it mattered at all. And I think it happens at every age in your life when you go through changes. I think you see it happening to Biff and Happy in their own individual ways, and you certainly see it happening to Willie Loman. What has it been for? What does it matter? And I think in a culture that was coming out of World War II, which had just come out of the Depression, I think we were seeing a lot of people more noticeably, not because it wasn't happening to women, but because it was more noticeable in men, starting to ask themselves what it was all for. And I think that's an issue that's at play in the story. The people first being brave enough to ask that question, and I know that it won a Pulitzer, it won Tonys, it's won so many awards. But one of the things I found fascinating in this Time Life thing was they also put in some letters that people had written after seeing the show who adamantly refused to get the point. A gentleman wrote, "I was disgusted with your appearance, Mr. Cobb. Don't you ever have your pants pressed? And why don't you go on a diet?" And then this is an apocryphal one because I don't know if it's really true, but they claim that a salesman who was leaving the theater said to another, Well, that New England territory always was tough. Oh. Well,
I think there were people who couldn't. We have to take a break. Oh, my gosh. When we come back, we're going to include you, the audience, into this conversation. Stay with us. This is the Maine Calling Book Club.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Maine Health, working with member organizations like Western Maine Health to help make our communities the healthiest in America. MaineHealth.org.
Do you even know when you're lying anymore, or is it just like blinking?
What do you want, Raylan?
Justified is heading toward the final showdown. The FX series is concluding its sixth and final season. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Justified's creator and showrunner, Graham Yost. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock.
Next time on Living on Earth in Kentucky, teaching evolution can be perilous, and so is explaining climate change.
Same kind of pushback, comments about I shouldn't be teaching it, it's not true, there's no evidence. That's not connected to religious beliefs, that's rejection of science.
Problems for science teachers in the Bible Belt. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Tune in for Living on Earth Sunday morning at 7 a.m.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, our book club reconvenes to discuss Arthur Miller's classic, Death of a Salesman. With me in our studio, John Mann, Chair of International Business, Policy, and Strategy, and a professor of management at the University of Maine. Tom Makatowicz is professor at UMaine School of Performing Arts, and joining us from our Portland studio, Christine Marshall. She's the artistic director at Mad Horse Theater Company in Portland. This weekend is the final weekend of the world premiere of Alligator Road by Maine playwright Callie Kimball at Mad Horse. We invite you to join our conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You know, a few months ago, our Maine Calling Book Club book was Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck. And there's part of this book that so reminds me of it. I know Steinbeck's was 1937, 12 years apart. But on page 26 of this copy, when the boys, Biff and Happy, are talking about what they want to do, and they talk of buying a beautiful ranch and working outdoors, it reminded me of George and Lenny and their dream of buying a farm and working a land, which also reminded me of what's going on right now in Maine, this movement, especially among young people, to farm again. And it made both books seem very modern to me. Is the same thing, did it occur to you all as well? Christine?
We produced Of Mice and Men several years ago, and it was an incredibly, I know it sounds odd, but it was an incredibly joyous experience. Somehow the end of that, this operatic feeling, is very different from Death of a Salesman. I think at that time, I think there were a lot of people who, again, post-war, post-depression, who suddenly found themselves in shoved back into something that was very, very tight and closed. And again, Joel Mauziner's set of the original play reflects that. And I think that our desire to step away and control something in our lives, have a little something of our own that isn't dictated to us by other people, is very powerful in the American experience.
It's funny you should bring that up, because what do we find Willie doing at the end of the play? Planting seeds in a backyard. And so going back to the farm, if you'd like.
Yeah.
But I think the feeling is quite different between Of Mice and Men and Death of a Salesman, in the sense that in Of Mice and Men, that comes out of pure naturalism, and there's a determinism that runs rampant through it. We know these people are never going to get their dream. They were born in socioeconomic circumstances that will prevent them. And so we feel sorry for them, and we know they're trying hard and they're working hard. Willie, on the other hand, if I can be a little controversial, he's a blowhard. He, you know, talks a big game, and we know he's a loser, and he's somewhat pathetic because of that. So at the end, his, you know, world falls apart. We see the stresses and strains of the family, And it's hard to root for him the way you would root for George and Lenny.
Okay, so you are controversial, because I want to ask you this, John Mann. As a professor of business, as somebody who's giving people advice about how to make it in business, Willie Loman thinks being physically handsome and making friends is what it takes. And is there any truth to that?
You know, sadly, the answer is yes. It really is, and I say that quite sadly. Often, you know, we still judge people on appearances when they walk in the door. And certainly you've all heard about, and I apologize for being genderous here, but the old boy network, which is alive and well. And even though he did not use that phrase there, I think the network of contacts and friends is still important today as it was then. And sadly, I think that very often people judge you on your appearance when you walk in the door.
And what about his... Oh, go ahead, Christine.
No, I was going to say that I agree very much. I actually don't think it's controversial, the statement about Willie. I think that's one of the things that also makes this play very daunting, is that it's hard to get behind somebody who is, it's hard to get behind him, you know? At different times, it's hard to get behind both Biff and Happy.
By the way, from a business standpoint, being a salesperson, you know, today when we think of a salesperson, we think of the man or woman behind a counter when we go into the store. Willie was the different type of salesperson, the guy or gal on the road who every day got feedback on their performance, good or bad. And part of the problem was the performance was somewhat out of their control. If the economy was slowed down, they didn't sell. And so every day, think about it, every day getting immediate feedback in your face about how good or poor you are. That's tough to live with.
And he was selling something that I'm going to guess was especially something that would only do well if the economy was good. Women's stockings. Yep. This is not something people are going to be buying if they're not
the analogy,
well.
And I'm blanking on the name, the pink Cadillacs, what's the woman's product?
Mary Kay Cosmetics.
Mary Kay. If you think Mary Kay Cosmetics, I'd say a Mary Kay Cosmetics saleswoman, I think they're mostly women, is the equivalent of a Willie Lomax. They're going out trying to sell door to door, and we don't see that very much.
The phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to, is it Margie or Margie in Jonesboro? Margie. Hi, Margie.
Hi there. Hey, you know what? Just a couple of points. Every person is somebody with something to give to the world. And I wrote a poem, and it's not me who you see. I'm me. In other words, the changes that take place during a person's life make them who they are. It's not who you see, because the baby looks will never last. And another thing is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. I'm not talking religion. What you've seen, what you sow, so shall you reap. If that's what people do through the world, we would be a better place. And all I have to say is everyone, every person is valuable. All the plumbers, all the bus drivers, all the people, you, the doctors, the lawyers, everyone has something to give to the world. And I'll tell you something, it's a great program, and I love it.
Well, thank you so much, Margie. And I think that most people would agree. And John Mann is over there clapping in your support. But Willie Loman didn't believe that.
Well,
he didn't really believe that everybody had intrinsic value. Christine.
That's the difference is not that, I mean, we want to believe and we hope to believe that everybody has a reason to be here. But it's what you think of yourself that is the issue in the play, really, to me. Yeah. It's their perception of themselves. Not that they have value as people, but that how they perceive that value.
Margie, thanks so much for calling in and taking part. Tom?
Well, I was just going to say this play grows out of psychological realism. That was the style of acting that was present. It's other people call it method acting. And so it's an attempt to get at the inner life of the character, not just train an actor externally, but to get in touch with the emotions and the feelings of a character. And I'll go back to my earlier comment that the worst lie you can tell is the lie to yourself. And I think that's the challenge for the actor playing this, that there's so many things going on psychologically with Willie that does he really believe in what he's purporting? And I'm not sure he does all the time. I think a great actor like Lee J. Cobb or Morris Karnofsky, they can bring out those dimensions of the character. But I think that, when you talk about self-worth and who you are, if you're believing your own lie, you're on the road to tragedy, basically.
There's so much to talk about. But I want to talk about the symbolism of the jungle. The brother, Ben, who's so successful, has gone into the jungle and extracted diamonds. John, what does the jungle in this book mean to you?
The jungle in this book means to me is trying to find your way through a place that's fraught with peril, pitfalls, and challenges. And I think you've made a very interesting comment there that Ben seems to have done it. And I think that Willie is both jealous that he has done it, disappointed that Willie didn't go, because remember, Ben invited him to come several times, and he just couldn't get himself to do it. So back to what Tom and Christine have been observing, Willie is living a lie of which he confronts it on so many levels, but he's still trying to live that lie.
Going to Nancy now in Deer Isle. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
A little different direction. I want to comment on the universality of the play. And I've seen it many times, but at one point when I was living in Cleveland, I went to see a production at the Caramu Theater, which is an all-black theater in Cleveland, with excellent acting. I believe it still exists, but it was a wonderful theater. And I brought a friend who was a vice president of sales in a British machinery company, and his job was to sell British machinery in the United States. And it brought him to tears. It brought him really to tears. And I just, this is a universal struggle for anybody who's out there trying to accomplish something in the world that is a jungle, that is a negative for him. That's all I wanted to say. Mm-hmm.
Can I speak to that jungle issue?
Yeah, go ahead, Christine.
I don't think that there's anything. I think it's an exotic story that is speaking to the issue of universality. It's exactly the same to me as someone saying, my brother-in-law went to Silicon Valley and he got involved in a dot-com startup and he has just walked away, you know, with $51 million and you got to get in on the ground floor. I mean, that has always been the case, I think. Since people have sold and bought things, there has always been an issue of that person who made it seemingly effortlessly. If only I was on board with that.
And John, you're nodding.
Well, I just have a very different question for Christine and Tom. Would you ever envision doing this play with Willie as a female?
No.
No, why not?
No, because it was like we did 12 Angry Men several years ago, and people said, why don't you put women in it? And I said, because if we're doing it in the time that it was taking place, they weren't there. I think this story is what it is, and there's a longing among actresses, myself included, to play some of the great male roles, but I don't know that it has to happen, and I think sometimes that can be a distraction from the actual story. I don't think you could do this script. I'm sure people will so disagree with me on this one. I'm in trouble now. I think it would be...
No. Christine, I think you'd make a great Henry Fonda in a white suit.
I have the table from the play still. Craig Robinson built us a table. It's in my house. With little knife holes in it from the knife being driven into it.
Yep.
I want to read an email. This is from Martha. Though Miller intended his play to be a post-World War II twist on the American dream, in 2015, the play can easily project forward into today's global markets that swallow, spit out, and use up the everyman of the 99%. Interesting comment.
Yeah.
That's true. There is another dimension, though. It's not. It's a little moralistic, but he does put in, idea that if you work hard, you'll actually achieve something, and that's definitely with Charlie and his son, basically, you know, just Charlie Oliver, I guess.
Bernard.
I'm blanking here, actually.
Bernard.
Bernard, that's right. Bernard becomes a very successful attorney, essentially, mm-hmm. because he studied, worked hard, Biff didn't.
And this is interesting because Bernard was the, I'm doing quotes with my fingers here, the nerd in mm-hmm. high school who studied.
Yes. Right.
And Biff was the football star, the handsome right. football star. And boy, I mean, this goes forward to happy days. This goes forward to, I think in most high schools today, Bernard would be the nerd and Biff would be the star. Go ahead, John.
But one of the things is, you know, when you think about the Biffs of today's world, that's tough to say. You know, we're looking at, you know, we've recently seen NFL players walking away from their career as young men. You know, when, you know, Biff thought he had it made. He thought he was going to go to college and be a football star and something great. If you just take a look at that for a moment, there's also that side of what do you do when you have a dream to be something and you can't make it? And even though that's not explored a lot with Biff, Biff, I think, is an embodiment of that. And I think that's true today. What do you say to young people who want to do certain things, but they can't do it because of physical limitations or other issues? How do you pursue the dream that you don't want to pursue?
Well, we're going to have to take another break. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is the Maine Calling Book Club. We're discussing Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to increasing recycling rates while reducing residential trash and landfill loads through zero-sort recycling. Casella, giving resources new life.
Friday on Morning Edition, the latest effort to create a new national park in Maine. And the legislature takes a look at bills to improve women's financial security. I'm local host Erwin Gratz. NPR will have the latest on the investigation into the French plane crash. Lou McNally will be with us to go over the weekend forecast. We'll hear from Marketplace and the BBC, too. Join me Friday for Morning Edition, 6 to 9 a.m. here on Maine Public Radio.
And join us following Maine Calling today at 1 o'clock for It's Your World, a panel discussion on redefining philanthropy and decision-making in philanthropy, a science or an art. Today's speakers, Darren Walker, president of the Ford Foundation, Larry Kramer, president at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Bradford Smith, president at the Foundation Center. That's It's Your World coming up at 1 o'clock following Maine Calling here on MPBN Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the Maine Calling Book Club gathers to discuss Arthur Miller's classic play, Death of a Salesman. With us today, Tom Makatowicz, Chair of UMaine's School of Performing Arts. John Mann, a Chair of International Business Policy and Strategy and a Professor of Management at the University of Maine. And joining us from our Portland studio, Christine Marshall. She is the Artistic Director at Mad Horse Theater Company in Portland. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. Another symbol I wanted to talk about briefly is the automobile. Throughout the play, the automobile is, in Willie's words, always breaking down. But the mom, Linda, shares with the boys that it's believed that he is crashing it. And at the end, it is the automobile, which is the most American of symbols, that in which he takes his life. Any thoughts on the symbolism of the automobile?
Well, you're right. I mean, I don't think there's a lot to say about that, but I do think that the automobile was big in the 20th century, and it's certainly going to be even bigger in the 21st century. But it was all about that sense of freedom, being able to drive and go. Like, and apparently the Studebaker, you could take the window out or lower the front window so you could feel the wind. You know, because that's in the play, they
right.
kind of he describes feeling the wind and driving on. So, yeah, he did use it that way. But, you know, you soon learn that maybe he's toying with suicide.
It's always breaking down, a euphemism.
It's yeah. Well, there's escape.
Well, the house is too.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Christine.
There's escape in the automobile. There's escape. You can get away. But would it be all right if I went back to that issue of Biff and
sure.
His failure. I mean, there's another issue. There are so many issues at play in this play, and one of them is he didn't sort of just fail from becoming the football star, there is a precipitating event there, which is him coming upon his father in a hotel room in Boston with a woman.
Right,
which
and discovering the betrayal.
He feels betrayed and loses his... He didn't do well in math. He was failing math. He was going to pick up the course, and then he maybe deliberately failed it. So I guess there is another issue at play there, which is what does that sense of betrayal in a family, you know, when you find out your parents are human, when you find out things that you never knew that change your perception of your whole world, and at the same time, how much truth is there in Biff's failure based on that confrontation, or is it now an excuse? Will he do that for the rest of his life? You know, I would have been somebody had I not found that out about my father.
Right, and I think they're real cause and effect here. You know, he's a kleptomaniac. He has lost many jobs because he's stolen things. He took the pen, and also the balls,
yep.
the sports balls from the job. And so you can see that, you know, the psychology in the play is very complex,
mm-hmm.
because the kind of abnormal behavior comes out in many different manifestations. But, he certainly has been affected by that traumatic event because he believed in his father. And I think this is the beginning of him understanding that it's all an artifice. That there's a lot of untruthfulness to all of the imagery and whatever that Willie was building up for him, you know, about succeeding in America and, you know, going on. In fact, later in the restaurant scene, he has to admit that he never was a salesman for this guy that he went to get the money from so he could start the sporting goods store, whatever. And Willie is, you know, tries to shift reality. The dialogue is very, very good, but it's very complex. It's, you know, he's trying to make it true, even though there's an acknowledgement that it isn't true.
That it isn't true. We're going to go. The phone lines are full. We're going to go to Frank in Hollowell. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks, Jennifer. I just have a change of pace. I just have a story about a main connection to the play. I have a friend who grew up in Calais, Maine in the 40s and 50s. And his parents ran a department store that sold women's clothes. And the family was Jewish, and they would invite up the New York salesman for clothes to come on Friday night so they could stay over and have enough men to have the synagogue service on Saturday. And one of the people who came up was a salesman who kept talking about his nephew, Artie. Artie was this smart kid, and he was first in high school, and he had a scholarship to Columbia. Artie's going to be a writer, and then Artie's writing a book about me. And soon after, The Death of a Salesman came out, and the guy came up and never mentioned Artie again.
Huh.
So that's my story.
And the nephew was Arthur Miller. That's a great story.
Yeah.
Frank, thanks for sharing that.
Okay, sure. Okay, bye-bye.
Yeah.
Wow.
Going to go ahead, Tom.
I was just going to say, they do mention Bangor in the script.
And Portland several
and Portland.
Times, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, going to Fred in Portland. Hi, Fred. Go ahead.
Hey, I was just going to comment. You actually touched on it a minute ago about the theme regarding substance over form, and when he talks, when Willie talks about being not just liked but well liked, and how important that is, and Biff is well liked, of course, and it's not that he fails at being an athlete, but he fails in his class, and of course it's crushing when he finds his father's having the affair. But he's failed already in substance.
Mm-hmm.
And later, when Bernard is going to be appearing before the Supreme Court, he heads off with I think a bottle of scotch or something that his dad gives him, and his dad tells Willie that he's going to appear before the Supreme Court. Well, isn't that amazing? Isn't that remarkable? He never said anything, and his dad said he never said anything because he's doing it. And that seems like
right.
a major theme in this play because Willie never is substance. Willie is always style over substance. His sons follow suit, and the people who succeed are the people who actually work harder. And I think that I think that that's a very telling piece, especially in the end game.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes this book so universal. Yeah, thanks, Fred.
Completely agree.
Going to Chris in East Machias. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Yes,
my call.
Chris, can you speak up? Are you close to your phone?
Excuse me?
I was just wondering if you could speak more loudly into your phone.
Yes, well, thank you for taking my call. And it was over 40 years ago when I was a sophomore at Gould Academy when we were taught this play. But there's one line in the play that has just stuck with me all these years, and I think it's in the play. I'm pretty sure it's "The woods are burning." I think Willie says that to his sons, and I think that what he's saying is the door of opportunity is closing, and you don't even see it.
I don't remember that line, but I believe you. Thank you, Chris. Right. And going to Carrie in East Winthrop. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just want to say thank you so much. This has been so delightful hearing all of this. And it takes me back to 1986-87 when my high school did this play. And it was just phenomenal. And I want to say thank you to all the high schools who continue to use this book in their schools and to do this play. It's so important.
Carrie, you performed this in high school. Do you think as a high school student you got it?
I think that I did to a degree. And, I mean, I have this story has come up from time to time. I'm really glad that this kind of literature still exists and that people are still having their students read these books. They're so important. And, you know, I can gain so much more from it today. But, yeah, I think I did get it.
Okay, thank you so much for calling.
Wonderful program. Thank you.
Thank you. A caller who couldn't stay on the line, who says he or she has done some work on stage, said that he loves the line, "Attention must be paid." Says it just gives me chills. One of you had mentioned that they love that line. John's flipping through his book right now. Christine, do you have a favorite line from the play?
I think "Attention must be paid" is the "I want my name" of this play. You know, I think it speaks to so many issues and a universal message about the human experience. Am I valid? Do I matter? Do I matter? Do any of us matter? You know, we can't help it in the dark moments when you think those thoughts.
John, what's your favorite line from the play?
I think there are a lot of great lines. Early on in the play when Linda's talking to Willie, and she says to him, "Well, dear, life is a casting off. It's always that way." For me, that's really profound. Think about it. We grow up, we go to school, we get married, we have children. Children move on. We move on in our life. It is about casting off.
What about you, Tom?
Well, I have a lot of famous favorite lines, but I don't want to talk about that, actually. There's an element that we haven't discussed yet, and it's one of Aristotle's six elements of drama, and that's music. And it's very interesting in the script to look at the music, all of the notes concerning the music, the very opening of Act One. "A melody is heard, played upon a flute. It is small and fine, telling of grass and trees and the horizon. The curtain rises." And the music goes on throughout. There are different scenes where he describes it, but certainly at the end of the play, there is the way the play is constructed and how they actually interweave the past and the present and all of the different scenes in action, music accompanies all of that. And the one where he runs off to commit suicide in the car, as the car speeds off, the music crashes down in a frenzy of sound, which becomes the soft pulsation of a single cello string. And so to me, that kind of poetic approach to the music really supports the action. And I was so impressed by that, just, you know, reading the stage notes.
That's really interesting. And let me ask you this, Christine. When you're thinking about staging plays, you talked about staging a different Arthur Miller play. Also in the conversation, you'd brought up that this play is relentless. I know there's so many debates that go on in the theater world. Do you do new work as you are doing right now, classics because people are familiar with and come? But how do you consider whether or not we stage a play that's just going to leave people wrung out, exhausted, and possibly pretty depressed?
I think that's a question that we continually ask ourselves. We're an ensemble, so we talk a lot before we choose our season about all the different things that we want to hit in the year. And I think that it's very, very hard. I mean,
We chose A View from the Bridge this fall. It's a classic, and it is brutal, but there's a different feeling at the end of it. My vote was not for Death of a Salesman as a production because it's very, very hard. It raises questions, and I'm not against asking the hard questions, but when we were looking at the pantheon of sort of Arthur Miller, there was something about View that to me, I don't know, it had more music to it, I'm not explaining it properly, but I think it's hard to choose plays like that. But I also think this, that reading particularly Miller, I didn't come to Miller until I saw Miller. I didn't get it until I saw it. And I think sometimes when you read plays, like he was just reading the musical notes, you don't get the full impact until you see people moving through the space and giving the words life. And I think when we read Death of a Salesman as a staged reading, it did give it that life, but it's still a tough message to share. But I think it's important, and this is not a plug for coming to see shows, but it's important that people see plays as opposed to only reading them, because the feeling is very different. How can you actually imagine a small flute that sounds like fields and an open space? Do you know what I mean?
Tom?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like to add on to Christine's comments a bit that there, when I grew up and I was a young theater student, I learned a very archaic concept that drama should be uplifting. And I soon realized that the way it was being defined by certain people, it really implied a certain censorship of plays like this or, any kind of a tragedy. I think that drama can be uplifting even when you see something as devastating as this play. And why? Well, I think it's because the audience recognizes the truth in what's being presented to them. And I think that trumps it all. I think that's why people go to the theater, to see the truth. And even though this could be a very, very difficult play, it can be a wonderful theatrical experience.
All right. Yeah. Well, those are going to be our last and wise words for a terrific program. Thank you all for joining us today. Christine Marshall, the Artistic Director at Mad Horse Theater Company in Portland. This is the final weekend at Mad Horse to see the world premiere of Alligator Road by Maine playwright Callie Kimball. My Facebook feed has been alive with people recommending it. Tom Mikotowicz is a professor at UMaine School of Performing Arts. John Mann is a chair of international business and strategy and a professor of management at the University of Maine. Next month, our book club returns on April 30th to discuss Lily King's award-winning novel, Euphoria. Inspired by the life of anthropologist Margaret Mead, Euphoria is the story of three young anthropologists in the 1930s caught in a love triangle that threatens their relationships and their lives. It has near universal acclaim, lots of awards. That's the Maine Calling Book Club on April 30th. John Camel ran the board today. Our volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls, and we had help in Bangor from Rich Tozier. Thank you to Rich. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as a link to our audio archives by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. The executive producer of Maine Calling is Jonathan Smith. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.